WR Boston and WRNI Providence. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Professor Leroy Rauner speaks on Christianity in the Coming World Civilization, Rethinking Hawking.
The old triumphalism was based in the dogmas of a conservative biblical theology, and Hawking is proposing a philosophy of history and culture.
The future of Christianity is tonight's topic on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, says what is needed to stabilize that country is not more American troops, but better intelligence and more cooperation from the Iraqi people. Bremer said guerrilla fighters and terrorists are entering Iraq from other countries and becoming a growing problem for U.S. forces. In southern Iraq today, three people were killed outside the office of one of the country's main Shiite Muslim leaders in the holy city of Najaf. NPR's Ivan Watson has details.
Grand Ayatollah Mohammad Sayyid al-Hakim is reported to have received minor injuries as a result of this explosion outside of his office. But his staff say that three of his security guards were killed in the explosion, and as many as 10 people also injured in this blast. Now, they are blaming this on former regime loyalists. It's anybody's guess who could have been behind this.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. The UN has pulled some staff members out of Iraq following last week's suicide bomb attack on a UN compound in Baghdad. Now the International Committee of the Red Cross is doing the same after receiving warnings that the group might be a target of future terrorist attacks. Nadu Amani is spokeswoman for the group.
It would be suicidal to stay here. It's not only for us, it's also for the Iraqis working for us. It's also for the people who come to visit us, for all the Iraqis coming and asking for different issues.
Amani says she hopes the Red Cross staff reduction is only temporary. A missile attack by Israeli helicopters has killed four members of the Hamas group in Gaza City, among the dead a senior Hamas commander. Earlier today, Israel's army chief had said that all members of Hamas are, in his words, potential targets for liquidation. Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien has toured burned-out neighborhoods in the western Canadian city of Kelowna. A wildfire destroyed over 200 homes in the city's suburbs east of Vancouver. Craig McCulloch reports.
The Prime Minister took a helicopter tour over the incinerated homes in the city's suburbs. He then toured the local emergency operations center and talked to some of the fire victims at evacuation shelters. This summer has seen the worst fires in decades, with over 800 currently burning in British Columbia. While not giving specifics, Mr. Chrétien says his government will help pay for the cost of fighting the fires and to rebuild affected areas.
We will find the money. You know, we find the money when we have the disaster. We don't say we don't have the money. We have to face that reality, and what we qualified, and the government will have to find the money.
Over 3,600 firefighters and soldiers are working to extinguish the flames. It is estimated that firefighting effort is costing at least $4 million a day. For NPR News, I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
Eight firefighters traveling from Idaho to Oregon were killed today when their van collided with a tractor trailer. This is NPR.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Reaction is still coming in to the news that former priest John Gagan was murdered in prison yesterday. Former ambassador to the Vatican Ray Flynn told Channel 5 that he had always concern about convicted priests' safety in prison.
Is anybody safe in prison? These are questions that I raised several months ago, and I guess we just found out yesterday that it's going to be very difficult to keep pedophiles in prison.
Gagan, who was serving a 9-year sentence for child molestation, was allegedly strangled yesterday by fellow inmate Joseph Druce at the state prison facility in Shirley. Amherst College has paid $4.3 million for nearly 37 acres of property. The college says it has no immediate plans for the property, which includes landscaped gardens and a 14-room house dating back to 1830. Most of that land is zoned residential and could have been developed into as many as 30 housing lots. And New Hampshire officials say that southbound traffic was flowing steadily through the Hampton tolls on Interstate 95 early this afternoon. Today is the third day of an experiment that doubled tolls on the northbound side to $2 and then eliminated the tolls for southbound drivers. That experiment will run for the next 6 weeks. In the forecast, clear early with increasing clouds overnight, lows between 55 and 60. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with highs in the upper 70s. Right now it's 71 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, MathWorks.com. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. At the dawn of the 20th century, theologian William Ernest Hocking envisioned a time when the fundamental tenets of Christianity would gradually permeate other societies, leading to a world of what Hocking called freestanding individuals prepared to fully participate in their own societies. Tonight, Professor Leroy Rauner, director of the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, analyzes Hocking's approach 100 years later. This lecture was originally recorded and broadcast last fall. Professor Rauner now on Christianity and the Coming World Civilization, Rethinking Hocking.
What is the single greatest achievement of modernity? Or as Ernest Hocking put it, not one to resist the occasion of rhetorical flourish, what is the best fruit of modernity? His answer to that question was not original. It was reflecting of the common wisdom, but it was telling in our age of analysis, which is also the age of autonomy. His argument was that the best fruit is the notion of the freestanding individual. The key component in the modern development of political democracy, economic capitalism, Protestant Christianity, and the empiricism which made modern natural science possible. And he asked, what is the freestanding individual standing on? And his answer to that was, he or she is standing on his or her right. And he noted, not only are we claiming this right for ourselves as freestanding individuals, we are also recognizing this claim for others. All freestanding individuals have basic human rights. So as isolated, freestanding individuals, we are making a universal claim. Now, Ernest Hocking pounced on this idea because to him it revealed the philosophical heart of the modern problem. How can a freestanding individual know that his or her right is universal? Ever since Descartes' enormously influential declaration that the possibility of knowledge begins with the realization that I think, therefore I am, the famous cogito ergo sum, we've had a problem. Descartes assumes also the universality of this affirmation. If he were only saying, I, René Descartes, exist, therefore I, René, am, we would have said, how nice for you, René. Go back to your stove and think some more. So the affirmation is universal, but once again, he has no very credible way of showing how we know that. The reason for that is that knowledge in the modern mind, which he was helping to create, is internal to the mind of the knower. Now, it was not always thus. For Aristotle, for example, the knower is related to the thing known, not simply in terms of the knower's obvious power to know, but also the power of the object to be known. So knowing is an event which takes place in the conjunction of these two powers, which is in the midst of an, therefore, intelligible world. Now, Descartes says, no. The world is made up of two radically different kinds. There are thinking things, res cogitans, you and me, and there are physical objects in the natural world, which for all their variety have in common the simple fact that they take up space. They are extended. They are res extensa. Our rationalisms and empiricisms go to work on them and know them, not because the things themselves have any spooky power to be known, but because the mind has the power of grasping and shaping its sense impressions of them, turning perceptions into conceptions within the mind. Knowing in the modern world takes place inside your head. Kant insisted you can never know the thing in itself, you can only know your conception of it. Therefore, every statement of knowledge has to begin with the phrase, I think, ich denke. The contemporary philosopher and theologian Paul Tillich used to take walks on Sunday afternoon in Riverside Park when he was teaching at Union Seminary in New York. And once walking with a friend, he encountered a flaming maple tree and he muttered, I know what the tree is to me, but what is the tree to itself? And he might have added, I know what I think, but how do I know the mind of my friend? Now, Ernest Hocking cut his philosophical teeth on this problem. The big issue for him was not the epistemological status of trees. The big issue was the status of other selves, what's come to be known in history of philosophy as the other minds problem. An age which declared universal human rights as its fundamental achievement had no way of saying how one could know that, because its theory of knowledge was mired in solipsism, the view that the only thing we can really know are the inner states of our own minds. And he set out to solve that problem. But first, let me tell you a little bit about his background. Ernest Hocking was a good Methodist kid from the great American Midwest. His father was a homeopathic physician. His mother was a school teacher. It was a religious family. The kids all had to kneel. There were eight of them. They all had to kneel in a circle after breakfast for morning prayers before they went about their business. And each of them had to memorize a biblical verse for that occasion. And on one occasion, I don't think he ever wrote anything about this, but he told me this story. He said, on one occasion, he said, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, and his father gave him sort of a sharp look, but didn't say anything. And the next morning, when they knelt in a circle, Ernest said, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, and his father said, you said that yesterday. And Ernest said, yes, but this is from a different chapter. He had more serious religious experiences than this. When he was 12, he went to a Methodist experience meeting, which always ended with an altar call to pray, come down and be saved. It was his first modest mystical experience. He joined other pious youths streaming down the aisles and had a vision, which he never forgot, of folk all over the earth in a procession of what he called men like souls walking. He was planning to be an engineer, eventually went to the University of Iowa at Ames, but he had developed an early philosophical interest through reading Herbert Spencer. His father caught him at it. He was 13 at the time and said that Herbert Spencer was nothing for a pious Methodist kid to be reading. So Ernest Hocking put the book away and hid it in the hayloft in the barn. He was responsible for looking after his father's horse, and so he read it surreptitiously while doing horse feeding duties. At Ames, when he was just entering college, he went to the library one Sunday afternoon and asked if there was anything new in philosophy. And the librarian handed him the two volumes of William James' Principles of Psychology. And he took it to a side table and read all afternoon. And by supper time, he had determined that he would go to Harvard and study with William James, which he eventually did. When he arrived at Harvard, James was in Scotland giving the Gifford Lectures, which became the Varieties of Religious Experience. And Hawking started taking courses with Josiah Royce, who introduced him to the other mind's problem. I know that I think, and I believe that others also think, but how can I know that, and how can I enter into the mind of the other? Royce had dealt with the problem by arguing that each individual mind participated in an absolute mind, and therefore indirectly in the mind of the other person. Hawking thought that was too abstract, and he wanted to find a solution in experience. And it says a lot about Royce, who, as I recall, was his major professor for his dissertation, that Royce encouraged him in this view that was critical of Royce's stance. And he said, that's your insight. You hang on to that. By this time, Hawking had already studied with James and was developing a kind of pragmatic idealism. In any event, true to his Midwestern roots, his had to be a philosophy of human experience. Now, solipsism, this view that the only thing that we can really know are the inner states of our own mind, is one of those interesting philosophical puzzles which present a virtually irrefutable argument for something which nobody believes. Why don't we believe it? We must have some experience, he thought, of sharing a common mind with others, which is not just occasional, like coming to an agreement. It must be fundamental to the nature of mind itself. But what kind of an experience would that be? And then one day it came to him. He was sitting outdoors with his wife, Agnes, who was a character. That's a whole other story. She was responsible, incidentally, for the... she was the founder of what later became the Shady Hill School. But that's another story. He was sitting there with Agnes, taking in the beauties of nature around them and looking somewhat quizzically at her. And this is what he wrote about that moment. This is from The Meaning of God in Human Experience, which was his first and greatest book. He said, I have sometimes sat looking at a comrade, speculating on this mysterious isolation of self from self. Why are we so made that I see of thee only thy wall and never thee? This wall of thee is but a movable part of the wall of my world, and I'm also a wall to thee. We look out at one another from behind masks. How would it seem if my mind could at once be within thine? And we could meet and without barrier be with each other. And then it has fallen on me like a shock, as when one thinking oneself alone has felt a presence. But I am in thy soul. These things around me are thy experience. They are thine own. When I touch them and move them, I change thee. When I look on them, I see what thou seest. When I listen, I hear what thou hearest. I am in the great room of thy soul, and I experience thy very experience. For where art thou? This is the interesting part. Not there, behind those eyes, within that head, in darkness, fraternizing with chemical processes. Of these, in my own case, I know nothing, and will know nothing, for my existence is spent not behind my wall, but in front of it. I am there where I have treasures, and there art thou also. The world in which I live is the world of thy soul. And being within that, I am within thee. And I can imagine no contact more real and thrilling than this, that we should meet and share identity, not through ineffable inner depths alone, that's a bow in Royce's direction, but here through the foregrounds of common experience, and that thou shouldst be not behind that mask, but here, pressing with all thy consciousness upon me, containing me and these things of mine. This is reality, and having seen it thus, I can never again be frightened into monadism by reflections which have strayed from their guiding insight. Now, Charles Hartshorne once said to me that he couldn't see the difference between Hawking and Bishop Berkeley's notion that nature is an idea in the mind of God. Hartshorne thought of Hawking as continuing the kind of subjective idealism, which goes back as far as the non-dualistic philosophers of ancient India, for whom nature is not a simple fact, but a symbol. For Hawking, however, nature is a simple fact. It is not a symbol, and it is not metaphysically purposive. What you see is what you get. Its purposelessness leaves us free to exercise our own purposes both in it and on it. Now, in their current zeal to overcome the Cartesian bifurcation of nature, as Whitehead so aptly called it, modern enthusiasts for Buddhist celebration of all living beings, or Christian advocates of creation spirituality, or Whiteheadian proponents of actual occasions, have made a purposeless nature come alive. And indeed, there is a very strong popular conviction abroad that dualism is a very bad thing. Hawking half agreed. His philosophical method was dialectical, and one of the virtues of a dialectical method is that you can half agree with almost anybody. He argued two things in response. One was a moral argument that we would not be free to dam rivers and fell trees unless nature were metaphysically purposeless. I once wrote an essay called The Survivor as Hero, criticizing him for this view. I'm a little more cautious now, reflecting on his second reason, which was that the cause-type view of a nature without its own inherent metaphysical purpose is the world of natural science. And modernity has indeed accepted that view. As Fechner put it, it is a night view in which we lonely thinking things are lost in the stars of an endless and purposeless universe. Hawking doesn't end with this view, as, for example, Bertrand Russell did. He insists, however, that it is where we must begin. It is true as far as it goes, if it stays within the limits of natural objects and does not try to include human minds. You can't get beyond modernity, he felt, by going around its problems. This night view, in fact, has produced our natural science, surely one of the great achievements of the modern mind. When Hu Shi, the great contemporary Chinese philosopher, mentioned to Hawking that one strength of Chinese philosophy was that, quote, we had no Descartes, unquote, Hawking countered that this prevented Chinese thought from producing a natural science. In the total scheme of the meaning of God in human experience, the purposelessness of nature, he believed, is given to us precisely for the purpose of developing a natural science. This fits with his dialectical method, which is not a reflection of Hegel or even of Royce, as much as it is a Midwestern American reflection on how experience works. We get an idea and are persuaded by it, and then we run up against something compelling, which is a counter-experience, and we think of that as the truth. And finally, on reflection, we find that there is something to be said for both, and we fashion a rough synthesis. This is how we learn things. And this dialectical movement is nicely illustrated by Whitehead's comment, sometimes I think that I am in the world, and sometimes I think that the world is in me. We begin with the natural realism of thinking that we are in the world. On reflection, however, we discover that our experience of the world is internal to our minds, so the world is really in me. Put these together in the synthesis which he experienced with Agnes, and the world becomes a world of other mind. There is then a second move to the dialectic, but that would take us astray from our topic this evening. Nature then turns out to be necessary for mind. It provides the content of thought. The Cartesian cogito is therefore incomplete. What needs to be added is, I think something. Therefore, I exist, and something else also exists. The mind is never, in his view, a tabula rasa, a blank slate. To be a mind is to think. To think is to think something. Mind without something to think about is an abstract myth. Now, if my daughter Christina were here, she's the one who says in the midst of my dinner table orations, Leroy, you are telling us more than we need to know. If she were here, she would say, Leroy, this is supposed to be about Christianity and the coming world civilization, so could you talk about that, please? Yes, dear. But the reason for this philosophical prolegomenon is that these were problems which Hawking believed Christianity had both helped to create and was helping to solve in the culture of the coming world civilization. Now, out of these reflections come two key notions. The first is that of what he called a widened empiricism. He is a philosopher of experience, but this means real experience and all experience. He rejects the way Hume narrowed experience so specifically to sense perception that he was unable to account for the notion of selfhood. Nor does he have any use for the scientism, which deals with human minds in the same way it deals with objects in the natural world. Nature has no inherent meaning, but human life does. He wants to include a measure of what he calls common mysticism in ordinary human experience. This is not far from the kind of synoptic intuition, as the historian Windelband called it, whereby Socrates grasped the true meaning of ideas like justice, which pure dialectic could not articulate. It is also not far from Santayana's notion of animal faith, that there is a reality beyond empirical immediacy, which is a realm of metaphysical meaning and moral purpose, and it also has something in common with John Dewey's call for a common faith. When Hawking lapsed into this curiously ecstatic Quaker thee and thou language, in the quoted passage from The Meaning of God and Human Experience, he was underlining his view that ordinary experience radiates meaning which cannot be analyzed but indicates the destiny which drives all significant ideas. So philosophy needs a notion of experience which includes everything from scientific fact to the common mysticism of what he called a nuclear experience. The second significant idea, which comes out of these reflections on the philosophical basis for modernity, is the idea of the passage beyond modernity. Now, forget everything you know about postmodernism. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about a cultural movement away from modern autonomy toward a world civilization. A new world culture will require a philosophical basis which can incorporate both mind and matter into a coherent worldview without denigrating the scientific need for a purposeless nature or the human need for a spiritual destiny. But a world civilization is going to be culturally pluralistic and will require some binding ingredient, as he called it, which he believes must be supplied by one of the great world religions. His question is, can Christianity make this needed contribution? This is clearly an important question, and Hawking was one of only a very few Christian thinkers who were asking it. The recent movement for interreligious dialogue, which I think is essentially over, I was going to call this section the happy, innocuous life of interreligious dialogue, was primarily driven by Christians, mostly Protestants, for important theological reasons. Christianity proclaims a God who acts in history to redeem the times, even entering into history in the Christ, thus making human history God's home. As a result, what happens in history is always grist for the theological mill. Karl Barth, who was perhaps the 20th century's greatest theologian, said we should sleep neither over our Bibles nor over our newspapers. Darwinism, for example, required a rethinking of Christian views of creation and evolution. Literary criticism required a new understanding of biblical texts. And the discovery of other great religious traditions requires a comparable engagement and rapprochement with them. This was an internal necessity for Christian theology in a way that it was not for Buddhists, Hindus, Confucians, Muslims, or virtually anyone else. But if you're a Buddhist monk meditating in your monastery and the morning mail brings you a round-trip ticket to a World Council of Churches interreligious dialogue conference in Geneva, you probably go. When you get there, everyone is supposed to explain why they hold the ideas and beliefs that they do, and the result will be greater common understanding. This dialogue movement was the successor of two previous Christian movements, the missionary movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries, seeking to win the world for Christ, during which folk of other religions expressed bemusement that there were so many Christian denominational groups trying to sign them up, and why didn't these people get together? This led to the Protestant ecumenical movement seeking to do just that, unite Protestant denominations into a single church. It was not a success, but the participants often didn't notice that and moved on to the even grander goal of the interreligious dialogue movement, seeking more common ground with people of other faiths and ideologies. The missionary movement ended with the decline of colonial rule, which had provided an umbrella under which their work could be done, even though colonial powers did not like missionaries because they stirred up the natives. The missionary movement ended because they had diminished support from home-based churches whose enthusiasm for converting the heathen was waning, and there were increasing restrictions placed on missionaries by newly independent third world countries who, like colonial powers before them, found the missionary presence disruptive. I was a missionary in India for 5 years, and our mission board secretary went to see Mrs. Gandhi when she was prime minister about gaining missionary visas, which were getting harder and harder to get. And she said, we're trying to keep out CIA agents. And he said, none of our missionaries are CIA agents. And she said, how do you know? The ecumenical movement ended when it became apparent that church mergers resulted in the loss of constituents and the creation of new breakaway denominations on the part of those who did not have the urge to merge. The interreligious dialogue movement ended because the Christians who initiated it did not want to celebrate the gifts and graces of their own religious tradition as much as they wanted to learn about other religions. There was much liberal guilt about all the bad things the missionaries had said about these nice Hindus and Muslims. There was also a measure of secularism among academic theologians, some of whom no longer had a strong faith, but still found religion culturally interesting. But relatively few wrote about the contribution which Christianity stood to make in the emerging world culture, which is ironic since Christianity is easily the fastest growing of all the great world religious traditions. Hawking refers to Christianity as the mother of the arts in Western civilization. We are all well aware that Christianity dominated Western culture in the medieval period, but most of us think of secularism as succeeding Christianity in the West. And when we think of the coming world civilization, we think of radical cultural pluralism, in which Christianity will be a much diminished influence, having had its day in medieval Europe, and the fresh faces on the cultural scene, Buddhism, Confucianism, Islam, and so forth, will be the religious folk to be reckoned with. Ernest Hawking didn't think so. Two things are at work here. One is his philosophy of history. The other is his interpretation of the passage beyond modernity. His philosophy of history is a rejection of the extreme liberal view of progress and also a rejection of the view held by Popper and Reinhold Niebuhr that there is no meaning in history. Hawking argued that history turns up certain ideas at the level of both technic and insight, which are unlosable. He admits that a lot gets lost in history, but some things once discovered are here to stay. Arts have been lost, but not the art of fire making, the taming of animals, the conquest of the sea, the art of printing. Sciences have been lost, even astronomies and geometries, but not the arithmetical zero or the science of proof. And in religion, the unforgettable, he says, may be more evident than the rationally final. Christianity, as the mother of the arts in Western culture, has fostered critical notions which have become part of history's unlosables. Modernity's problem was the two cultures which developed from Cartesian dualism. Hawking argues that both of those cultures, the technical culture of modern natural science and the personal culture of modern subjectivity, are unlosable. We can never forget our natural science. We can never forget the individual human being standing on his or her right. And where did these notions come from? He argues that they came from Christianity. And he makes bold to say, and this is a quote, "If we rightly read the story of the genesis of modern science and answer the question why its relentless logic appeared only in Europe, we shall see that it is the religion of Europe which begot the empirical conscience and thus indirectly all its fruits." Bacon's principle of empirical observation, quote, "We cannot command nature except by obeying her," unquote, reflects in Hawking's view the paradox of the Christian moral teaching, "He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." Descartes' cogito ergo sum, as a number of people have noted, is a restatement of St. Augustine's earlier formulation, "Si follower sum," if I err, I am. And Kepler's view that the genuine causes of physical processes are homogeneous with the effects, which today we express by saying that the events which constitute nature are a closed group, was required by a theological conviction. And this is another quote from Ernest Hawking. "This austerity of mathematical principle," Kepler considered, "was alone compatible with that world of perfect law which is God's thought, and whose beauty is at the same time its freedom from incongruous admixture." Now, Hawking does not lament the way secularism has influenced Western culture. Rather, with his indefatigable optimism, he sees secularism as freeing Christianity and what he calls the unbound Christ from its provincial ties to the Western world. The key to Christianity's fitness for providing what the coming world civilization needs is its responsibility to history and culture and its resulting capacity for reconception. Traditional religion focuses on memory and tradition, preserving the integrity of the way things have always been thought about and been done. Because of its historical consciousness, Christianity argues that, as the old hymn puts it, "New occasions teach new duties, time makes ancient good uncouth." Now, in the years since Hawking wrote his book on the coming world civilization, that was published in 1956, it has become increasingly apparent that reconception is happening to all of the world's religious traditions as they encounter one another. American Buddhism, for example, defends the notion of human rights, even though the individual self is the bearer of rights, which is clearly counter to Buddhism's no-self doctrine. I once had a wonderful interchange with my friend Tai Uno, a Buddhist priest who taught at Smith College, and we were at a human rights conference in Hawaii, and I was giving a paper on human rights, and, And in the discussion period afterwards, I said to him, Tai, you know, I don't understand how you guys, meaning you Buddhists, can have a doctrine of human rights, because rights, the bearer of rights, is the individual. And you have a strong no-self doctrine or perspective, which leaves you without anybody to bear the rights. And I was needling him, and he knew that, but he got quite exercised by it. And he said, Lee, of course I believe in human rights. I'm an American. Now, what's going on here? A lot of theological or philosophical inconsistency is being overcome by other loyalties, other insights, and so forth. So reconception is going on every place. Hawking's point about Christianity is that its reconception is self-generated and intentional, a reflection of its own deepest essence. And Christianity, he thought, gives promise of fulfilling its inherent universality by carrying out the work of reconception in a way that reaches beyond its own cultural limitations as Western. In adapting the concept of experience from existentialism, for example, Christianity gives evidence of a passage beyond philosophical modernity. It has engaged the night view of modern subjectivity, riven with angst, incorporating Kierkegaardian psychology into its view of human nature. And in ending its warfare with science and in seriously attempting to maintain relevant connections with the life of the modern world, Christianity moves beyond modernity's narrow concept of experience toward a widened empiricism, which can include both the cause-tight, purposeless world of science and the open, purposeful world of human destiny. And in the growing openness to its own conviction that God is not without witnesses in other religions and cultures, Christianity begins to live in terms of its inherent universality. He had several allies in this venture. I once had occasion to visit with Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan when he was president of India. He had contributed an essay to a volume which I edited, a Festschrift, in honor of Ernest Hawking. And Radhakrishnan was a lot of fun. He knew that I taught theology as well as philosophy. And when I came in to see him, he said, don't quote the Bible to me, boy. I know the Bible better than you do. He was a graduate of Madras Christian College, and he won all the Bible prizes at Madras. And he said, where does this quote come from? Lead us from darkness into light. I said, that's St. John's Gospel. He said, no, it isn't. It's the Upanishads. Well, he was, you know, he was pointing out that there's a great deal of crossover, of common ground in perceptions among various religions. And he also always felt that he and Arnold Toynbee and Ernest Hawking were his allies in this venture toward greater awareness of that fact. So the question arises, is this the old Christian triumphalism with a softer and more philosophical voice? I don't think so. The old triumphalism was based in the dogmas of a conservative biblical theology, and Hawking is proposing a philosophy of history and culture. He just thinks this is what's going on, and he's presenting an argument for it. He's also making predictions about the future, and here his broad brush references to Christianity make him open to the same criticism that Reinhold Niebuhr was always subjected to for his vague and general references to biblical religion. Hawking makes it clear, however, that he's not talking about the dominance of a religious institution. He is talking about the influence of certain religious ideas and values. The second half of his book on the coming world civilization sets forth his interpretation of Christianity, centering on the teachings of Jesus and his prescription for interreligious dialogue, which the next generation of Christian philosophers and theologians pretty much ignored. What he's doing there, interestingly enough, is a recapitulation of St. Augustine's argument that Christianity was the natural religion of humankind. Hawking was persuaded that everyone shares a fundamental human experience of a sense of awe at our place in the cosmic order, a sense of personal destiny. We have a task which in some sense we have given ourselves or somehow a task that we have to fulfill, and that this fundamental nuclear experience, as he calls it, is the germ of human religious sensibility. And his argument was that Christianity was the particular spelling out of the implications of that initial germ. I think he's made a pretty good case for his point of view, and one which is much more substantive than most of the popular work in this field subsequently. What I miss is a discussion of how he thinks this is going to work. He has a philosophy of history generally, but he doesn't have a philosophy of the coming world civilization in that sense. He has a projection, but he hasn't shown how Christianity was going to affect that culture. I think what he really thought was that Christianity in its present state didn't need a missionary movement. He oftentimes said, you know, modern natural science didn't need a missionary movement. Everybody wanted it. Now, when Tai Uno says, of course I believe in human rights, I'm an American, is he in effect saying that Hawking would say the influence that Christianity had on American culture and in helping to establish this status of the freestanding individual is spreading itself. There are several who have argued that, and that's the implication of what he has to say. In his original essay on American civil religion, Robert Bella allowed for the possibility of a world civil religion, but never developed that idea. I have had a go at this issue myself in a book called To Be at Home, which was subtitled Christianity, Civil Religion, and World Community. Hawking admitted, however, that the world religion would not necessarily be called Christianity, but would be Christian in the substance of its fundamental ideas and values. And I leave you with a practical illustration about how that worked for him personally. In the early 1930s, he was in Sri Lanka, then Ceylon, doing the research work for his evaluation of the missionary Protestant missionary movement. And he was visiting with a Buddhist monk in a temple and admiring a statue of the Buddha. And he said to the monk, "Do you pray to the Buddha?" He said, "No, we pray to the Bodhisattva, who one day will come and be with us." And Ernest Hawking said, "Do you yearn for that coming? Do you hope for that coming?" And he told me the monk's face just lit up, and he said, "Oh, yes." And Ernest Hawking said, "I join you in that hope." Thank you.
Professor Leroy Rauner on Christianity in the Coming World Civilization, Rethinking Hawking. To respond to Professor Rauner is the Dean of the School of Theology, Robert Neville.
That was a wonderful discussion of Christianity's contribution to culture, of reconceiving the tradition so that we can address new circumstances. But I wonder, in our circumstance, about the extent to which that is just a liberal fantasy. It's one I entertain myself and I work on. That's what I do for a living. But I wonder whether it's a fantasy. There's a tremendous explosion of Christianity going on, to which Professor Rauner alluded. But it's giving rise to a kind of new Christendom. The old Christendom, European Christendom, everyone says is dead, but the new Christendom seems to be pretty intolerant, and that's because it's fighting for its own way. in circumstances where it's not easily tolerated itself. It's exclusivistic for the same reason, and it takes itself to be fundamentalistic. That is, conservative, the fundamentalistic biblical religion, perhaps, as Leroy was talking about it. In fact, it's not conservative at all, because when Christianity is becoming enculturated, say, in Africa or other places where it has not been before, it has to do tremendous transformation. But its self-perception and its rhetoric appears to many other people as conservative. That's not much reconceiving, if you think of it in the way that Ernest Hocking was thinking of it. And so I wonder whether or not the virtue of Christianity reconceiving itself, which began at the earliest times, the earliest letters we have, of the earliest biblical letters we have in Christianity are St. Paul's, where he was reconceiving the meaning of this rural Galilean for an urban Hellenistic culture. And you can see in the book of Acts the entry of Gentiles into the Christian movement, and the fact that Jesus didn't come back when he was supposed to, meant that they had to reconceive the earlier premises of the religion. It certainly was true. And modern liberal Christian thought, Catholic and Protestant, is very much a function of reconceiving. But that might be lost in 500 years if we have a millennium of the new Christendom, which clamps down on that. I wonder what your reflections on that might be. I like very much the discussion of the missionary movement and its collapse, the ecumenical movement and its collapse, and then the interfaith movement and its collapse. But I wonder if we might tell the story differently, not to exclude the story you told, but how important are these factors? The missionary movement was so successful in many parts of the world that it started indigenous churches, which pretty quickly threw out the missionaries, as missionaries weren't needed anymore. And in fact, as the religion became indigenized in Korea or Africa, there was no reason to have foreign missionaries there. In fact, they were kind of a holdover from the pre-indigenized and fundamentally alien form of Christianity. So the missionary movement was killed itself off by its own success, which is a kind of happy death. And the missionary movement is reviving now in the places where it is, such as Africa, by virtue of being very alert to this temporary character of mission. The ecumenical movement, I think, did collapse. I think you're right about that. But isn't it because of terminal boredom? The ecumenical movement thought that the way to get people together from different denominations and churches was to find the least common denominator. And therefore you get these dreadful documents like the BEM document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, about the dullest theology you could possibly have. And if the ecumenical movement does nothing more than that, then along with the fact that merging churches means that disaffected people will leave and people will fall away, it seems to me that boredom is one of the things that's really, it's a fatal disease for any religion. And then when it came to the failure of the interfaith movement, I'm not quite so sure that it's dead yet, but I think it's being transformed by the success of multiple religious identities. When Confucians go off to talk with Christians, they decide to join up with each other's religions without abandoning their own. John Berthrong, our colleague, has written a lot about the extent to which people, either explicitly or implicitly, have borrowed religious ideas and practices and identifications, and even go so far as to borrow other traditions' histories and make them compatible with our current life. Life is fragmentary as it is. You might as well have lots of religions be part of that fragmentariness. And if we can learn to live with the fragmentariness of life, something that nearly, a problem that nearly every religion addresses, then we can learn to live with multiple religious identities. This is a problem for the elites that engage in interfaith dialogue, but it's also something that happens locally when there's a small town with people of different faiths living together. They very frequently adopt one another's holidays, and from you go to the holidays to the marriages, and then on you go. My last question has to do with how to think about Hawking's analysis of European modernity. And I wonder if it might not be doubly wrong. I appreciate the point about subjective and intersubjective individualism. But I think that he did not take into account sufficiently the extent to which even the formation of an individual requires participating in a culture that can be viewed as a semiotic system or perhaps a ritual system, so that the acts that any one person performs, those are acts that are conjoint acts with other people. And so there has been an individualistic stream in modern European culture, but it has been misdirected. And in point of fact, even in trying to be individualistic, European culture is ritually interwoven, and so that acts are most usually conjoint acts. Hasn't it also been a mistake to think that nature is without purpose and value? Not purpose, perhaps, in the sense of a subjective purposer intending things, but the conception of nature as being just facts that we have at our disposal to use as means for our own human purposes, that seems to me to be, first of all, simply wrong, because we experience nature as having values, and mischievous, because it gives rise to an over-technological approach to nature. You don't have to be a nature romantic to argue that there's some point to the ecological appreciation of value in nature. And then, to take up on your point about your citing of Hawking's point about the humility of human beings learning from nature, they would not derive purposes for human life if they did not see value in nature, because even human nature has to be part of nature. And I don't think that Hawking, or the truth of the matter, would argue that our purposes are merely projections. They're responses to how we ought to organize ourselves, orient ourselves in light of what's important in nature to be doing.
Robert Neville, Dean of the Boston University School of Theology. Earlier, we heard from the director of the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, Leroy Rauner. This lecture was originally recorded and broadcast last fall. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Perotti with help from George Hicks and Joe Rondazzo. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
This is Dolores Handy. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the latest news from Iraq as the investigation continues into the